funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the value of victory in sports? Parents sign their kids up for organized athletics with a variety of good intentions, to teach cooperation, to develop physical strength and coordination, maybe even to give them a shot at scoring a college scholarship down the road. But while those long-term goals sound admirable, my guest today worries that too often they take a backseat to the short-term thrill of a winning season, so that even before they hit puberty, millions of American kids are pushed off teams and written off as potential athletes. Tom Ferry is a correspondent for ESPN. He explores the issue in his book, just out in paperback now. It's called Game On: How the Pressure to Win at All Costs Endangers Youth Sports and What Parents Can Do About It. Tom, welcome to Think.
Good to be here, Chris.
What do you see as the chief benefits, when all is going well, of kids playing sports?
Well, I'm a father of three, so I see it on a I see it in my town here with my kids. I mean, it's there are all sorts of values that kids can pick up. It's cooperation, it's picking yourself up after losses and moving forward. It's striving for something, a common goal, individual goals. It's, again, learning how to work with other people. I can go on and on and on. There are a lot of potential character traits that can result from playing youth sports. That's why I call it the most important institution in all of sports. But unfortunately, it's not, we don't always see those values being delivered.
Well, you know, the phenomenon you describe is that we're not so much teaching kids how to win and lose, we're teaching them how to win.
Yeah, well, and it's in more clearly than that, it's not that we're teaching them how to win, we're just telling them to win. I mean, a lot of the times we don't even teach kids the fundamentals of a sport. We just sort of stick them in this endless array of competition starting at very early ages now. I mean, things have changed so much since we were kids, Chris. I mean, there are now second-grade national championships in basketball. There are world championships in golf for 5- and 6-year-olds. There are, you know, in every town, mine, I'm sure in the Dallas area as well. I mean, travel teams, which are basically select-based, tryout-based teams, starting, I don't know, third grade or so, you know, and the best kids, the quote-unquote best kids in a particular community, go off and play the best kids in another community. And things have gotten so much more focused on elite competition and organized competition at such an early age that the equation has really changed.
One of the concerns you have is that coaches now are really driven to win, even, as you mentioned, with very young kids. Do their jobs depend on their records, even at the elementary and middle school level?
Oh, I think so. I think, you know, parents are organized around the idea of the winning team is a good team, that their kid is being served well by being on a winning team. But, coaches are held accountable for that. I mean, it's hard for a coach to come in and say, yeah, I know we lost every single game this year, but, boy, those kids, you know, they picked up certain basic skills. They're going to help them 3 or 5 or 10 years down the road, or they learn certain life lessons. And, I mean, parents appreciate all this stuff, but Americans are very bottom-line oriented, and we like to, assess victory based upon real obvious measurements. And what more obvious measurement is there than to look up at the scoreboard and see a result that suggests that your team, achieved on that day better than some other team did? And it's just very much a short-term type of thinking. The book that I've written is not a rant against competition or developing elite athletes or anything. It just points out the hazards in asking kids too early to win, as opposed to developing them as athletes and as citizens. I mean, imbuing the kind of character traits we want to see in kids.
Yeah, and it turns out that while kids certainly like to win as much as anybody, those victories tend to be much more important to the adults that are invested in these games.
Yeah, it's true. You know, it's interesting. You see kids, you know, if you look at the reasons why kids play sports, number one, boys and girls, school sports, non-school sports, is what the surveys say of thousands of kids, is that they all, number one is to have fun. Number two is really to, you know, is to be among their friends, is for social reasons. It's especially true with girls. You know, also Pi is the challenge of competition and to test themselves and to get better. Fairly low on the list is the mandate, quote-unquote, to win. They all want to win. A lot of them really want to win. They may even cry at the end of the game. But 5 minutes later, for most kids, especially little kids, they're done with it. They've moved on, and it's the parent who is still talking about what went wrong in the game on the way, on the ride home or at dinner that night. And, you know, it's the parent who sort of gets all concerned and signs them up for camps the next day, even if the kid really isn't into getting into clinics, because, you know, parents end up focusing on the result a lot more than kids do. Kids are much more in the moment. They will pour their heart out. They will play very hard, but they move on much more quickly.
And it's worth pointing out that a losing soccer team gets as much exercise running around on the field as the team that, that probably takes the trophy.
Well, that's true. And that's true. And that's all the more reason why you want to create broad-based programs that that aren't so exclusive, where the, you know, it's you know, the winner is out, or the kids who aren't achieving or don't appear to be the best athletes can't make a team. I mean, we've seen one real big shift over the past generation is inexpensive, widely available recreational sports have really gone by the wayside. By middle school, certainly, you know, teams have already pretty much figured out who's going to be our high school baseball team and who are going to be the soccer players and so forth. And these rec leagues where you do have lots and lots of opportunities to you know, for kids to play, to win, and to lose, they disappear, and they certainly disappear in my community. And I live up here in Connecticut, where we're supposed to be kind of reasonable and more moderate than elsewhere in the country. So, you know, again, it's just a different equation now.
And of course, we all love the stories of these remarkable, you know, wunderkind sort of phenom athletes that start so young. But you have some really interesting research in the book about the relationship between early athletic promise and later performance. And there isn't necessarily a direct correlation.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, you know, what happens when we, you have these cases where we hear about. There's Tiger Woods, who, you know, his dad put a, you know, club in his hand at a very early age and pressed all the bright buttons, and presto changeo, out came an elite golfer and, you know, a seemingly pretty good guy despite some of his recent behavior on the golf course. You know, went on to college, went to Stanford, holds himself in the public eye pretty well, and the kind of kid that you know, most parents would be proud of. I mean, they're the Andre Agassis. I mean, there are these kids who have gotten lots of training at a very early age had been turned by their parents into pro athletes. But a lot of times what happens is, much more often, is these kids end up rebelling. You know, they're tired of it. They you know, by the time they're 15, 16, 17 years old, they just want to play the guitar, or they want to play some other sport, or they want to spend more time around their friends. They want a little more diversity. It's really the unusual kid who is, you know, can be put on a track of, you know, 10 to 12 years of intensive training, and then get to the end of high school, and he still has that love of the game and wants to go out there and conquer the world in that particular game. I mean, most kids want to explore. They're adventurous. And so there's a real hazard in trying to ask too much of kids at too early of an age in terms of achieving in sports and thinking about some down-the-road payoff, whether it be a scholarship or a pro salary or otherwise. You know, there was a football player that many people are familiar with named Todd Marinovich a few years ago, whose father in the 1970s said, you know what, I'm basically going to try and make an NFL quarterback here. And he did. This kid went on to play at USC, first-round draft pick in the NFL, played with the Oakland Raiders, but he ended up washing out after two or three years, because although he was brilliant at the game, had this incredible gift that had been developed for playing, for throwing a football, he just he was never fully developed as a man, really. He was developed as an athlete, and he just kind of washed out in a haze of drugs, and he just didn't quite know what to do with his life, and certainly his non-football life. And, you know, that cautionary tale was told in the 1990s, but ever since Tiger came along, that's kind of erased the cautionary tale of Todd Marinovich and Marv Marinovich, and now you have a nation of parents who really believe you can. Boy, if I focus my kids starting at 3, 4, 5, maybe even earlier, on a particular sport, I can really do something with that. And some of them are going to find success, but a lot of them really are not.
Well, what's interesting about that is that it seems as if a lot of parents on the sidelines are competing as much with other parents as they are sort of watching their kids compete with other kids.
Yeah, that's really a good observation, Chris. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, again, competition isn't bad. I mean, we live in a competitive society. You want kids to compete, but what's happened in youth sports is it's the parents who are competing against each other instead of often the kids who are doing the competing. And that's where you get into trouble, because then the experience youth sports becomes something that it's the idea of the parents and it's all about them. Whereas if we look at youth sports through the lens of kids and what they're looking to get out of it, you're more likely to have a kid enjoy the sport and develop a passion for the sport and actually become really good at it. So it's whenever people ask me about this, I'm like, all right, well, competition's good, but make sure it's got to come from the kid. It can't come from the parents.
Yeah, meanwhile, there are plenty of potential athletes who might, in fact, be really good after they hit adolescence or even get into their late teens or early 20s. But they're sort of shut out of sports because they weren't at the top of their game in third grade.
Yeah, that's part of the problem with creating all of these travel teams in grade school. Of the grade school age. And look, I'm one of those parents. I let my son play travel soccer in third grade. He's still playing, and he's going into seventh grade now, and it's been a pretty good experience for him. But what happened in our town is pretty typical of what happens in a lot of other towns. There were tryouts in third grade. A number of kids got cut. The kids who made the team were generally, more advanced physically. My son was bigger than other kids. He could boot the ball down the field, so therefore he could help the team win. He wasn't necessarily any better with his foot skills. He wasn't necessarily any better of a candidate to develop as a soccer player, but he was going to help that team win at an early age, and he did. So now this team, they don't really have other kids coming out to try out for it. I mean, they hold these tryouts, and there might be one or two other kids who try and make the team, but the bottom line is, in third grade, what we effectively have done is we push aside the late bloomer, the kid who hasn't grown into his body and won't grow into his body until he's 12, 13, 14 years old. You end up pushing aside the kid from the single-parent home whose mom can't get him to all of the endless slate of practices and games and tournaments. You push aside the kid from the lower-income home who can't afford the expensive the $200 bats and baseball and the out-of-state tournaments, and you push aside the kid from the family that simply wants a little bit of balance and doesn't want to turn over their entire summer or every holiday weekend to yet another tournament. So this whole ramped up culture, really it benefits some. And again, my son has had a good experience, but I'm also I also know that there are a number of other kids who have been pushed aside.
Tom Ferry is my guest. He's a correspondent for ESPN. His book has just been re-released in paperback. It's called Game On: How the Pressure to Win at All Costs Endangers Youth Sports and What Parents Can Do About It. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. You can get on the line right now to join us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email us at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is ESPN correspondent Tom Ferry. His book is called Game On, How the Pressure to Win at All Costs Endangers Youth Sports and What Parents Can Do About It. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Tom, I have to imagine that there are parents out there who have kids on these sort of advanced traveling teams who say, look, if I kept my kid playing sports at the Y in our neighborhood, maybe I would be keeping her from advancing to the greatest of her ability.
Well, there's actually a lot of truth to that, Chris. Mm-hmm. That is one of the reasons I let my son start playing travel soccer in third grade, because you look at the high school team and every one of those kids is playing travel ball. No one just picked up the sport in eighth grade or was just playing, you know, YMCA ball until eighth grade. So, you know, fortunately, unfortunately, you kind of do have to get your kid on a track at an early age these days. The question is just how much is too much. I mean, a number of coaches will, and first of all, look, there are a lot of great coaches out there, and I want to state that up front. I mean, a lot of wonderful people in the space who are trying to very much do right by kids. But there is an impulse out there to turn, you know, each sport into a year-round activity. There's a fall league and a summer league and a winter league and a summer session. And it's just sort of this endless slate in the sense that you're going to fall behind unless you have your kids specialize in one sport at a very early age. And really, the research doesn't support that at all. I mean, the research says that if kids play multiple sports and get good coaching at an early age, they're gonna be better athletes down the road. You know, I think of like Roger Federer, who's probably my favorite athlete, mm-hmm. And you know, the world's best tennis player. Well, his game starts with fantastic footwork. That footwork did not come from playing tennis exclusively since the age of four. It comes from him playing soccer. He played a lot of soccer until he was, you know, 13, 14 years old. And that football is, that soccer, as we call it here, those are transferable skills that made him a better player in tennis. And you see this across sports. I mean, most lead athletes can tell you that they picked up some valuable skill from playing some other sport. Sometimes kids are the star on a particular team, but in another sport they're a role player, and that's valuable as well. That maybe teaches them to be better team players. It keeps playing multiple sports, keeps a kid's body fresh. They're less susceptible to overuse injuries. They're less susceptible to, you know, mental burnout from a particular sport. So you got to be really careful. You got to, you know, you can't ignore the environment out there as a parent. I mean, things do become elite early on. You just have to kind of pull back here and there. So, for instance, with my kids' soccer team, when the coach wants to do out-of-state tournaments, I'm like, you know, let's just keep it in-state. I advocate for keeping it reasonable. Maybe we'll skip the summer sessions, or we'll do one of the winter sessions. We do just enough to keep my kid in the pipeline, but at the same time, he's playing, you know, three, four other sports during the course of the year, and we're still trying to carve out enough time for our family to do things together. And the kids, you know, one important thing that people always forget about is the value of free play, you know, driveway play, pickup play, backyard play. The best soccer players in the world are made in Brazil, and that's in part because they teach technique very well down there. But those kids also just spend a lot of time alone with the ball, maybe kicking with an uncle or a brother or a father, and they develop this technical proficiency that, you know, that is the essence of the beautiful game. They become these fantastic players because of what, you know, the relationship that they have between their foot and the ball. And we have more kids in soccer uniforms than any nation in the world, and we have yet to produce one truly world-class soccer player. And that's in part because things are so hyper-organized at such an early age here and so tactical. So kids end up just learning how to play one position and a limited set of skills, and they don't touch the ball all that often because they're playing so many games. Because, you know, in the course of a game, particularly a baseball game, you might only touch the ball three or four times. And it's not necessarily even the best way to develop an elite athlete. So, you know, build in time for free play for your kids.
Another thing that you'd like to see, which I think is really interesting, is a greater amount of training for coaches, not simply in the best tactics for executing a game, but in child psychology and child physiology, because sometimes really well-meaning people come to coaching without any of that background.
Right, right. You know, in most countries, particularly European countries, youth coaches have to get certified. They get training in kinesiology and psychology and, you know, how to communicate with little kids, and they learn what's age appropriate. You know, what can you teach? What should you teach, you know, an 8-year-old soccer player versus a 12-year-old soccer player? You know, how much, what ratio of practice to competition do you want to have? What's most effective at you know, developing an elite athlete, or simply having kids come back and play the next year? In this country, the way it's evolved is parents are the coaches, and the vast majority of them are not required to get any type of training, either in technique, you know, in learning what's age appropriate with kids, and in terms of communicating with kids, how to make it a good experience. And so they're winging it. They're out there doing the very best that they can, but it's, you know, their instinct is, well, let's play a game and let me manage the process here and let me put this kid, you know, at this particular position, and it becomes people are winging it, and it's just not a recipe for success. So I think there's really a role there for every parent and every community to kind of push your local soccer board or even push your town recreation council to insist that coaches be trained in the sport and what's age appropriate with kids and how to teach character through sports. I think if you do that, the studies actually show that kids are much more likely to sign up year after year.
Tom Ferry is my guest. His book is called Game On, How the Pressure to Win at All Costs Endangers Youth Sports and What Parents Can Do About It. Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak to Ben in Fort Worth. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Chris. Great show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about larger families, and I had a cousin growing up who was one of these great, you know, baseball prodigies. He was a pitcher and was on a traveling team, but my uncle and aunt were out of town all the time, and I'm now a parent of 3 children, and my wife and I would like to have one more child, and I'm just envisioning, you know, if my son, who's today only 5, in a few years becomes, you know, this prodigy. And then, you know, one of my other children also shows chance of success. How do I do this sports thing that's taking every weekend of my time for multiple children, potentially in multiple sports? And maybe as part of that and the value of just family, leading more and more families to reevaluate, well, you know, maybe my child won't become the next Nolan Ryan, but he can play in the Y League and learn character and some of those same things that your guest was just talking about.
Right. Yeah. Well, I would encourage you to look to put your kid in programs where they really teach technique and they emphasize fun and fundamentals. And if you do that, as opposed to sticking them in a program where it's just an endless slate of games where you're constantly having to truck them off to this, you know, this game or this tournament or whatever else it may be, your kid will actually develop better as an athlete, and you will, and you'll have a little more space in your life to do your family thing. Just don't buy into the notion that competition equals development, because it's really not the case. Yes, there's a place for playing games. Yes, there's a place for competing, but the endless slate of games, you know, fall, winter, summer, it's not going to create a better. It's not going to serve your kid as an athlete well, and it's not going to serve your family as well. So just try and put them with good coaches and, clinics and advocate, like I said earlier, with your local, soccer body or otherwise to get local coaches trained. It's not that hard with all of the online tools that are available out there.
I think one thing that makes your book really valuable is that it is full of myth-busting facts, one of which is an examination of the whole scholarship issue. Many people who would have a hard time affording college assume that sports is a really good avenue to getting your child into a 4-year university. Can you talk a little bit about the reality, including the fact that the majority of these scholarships actually go to wealthier kids as opposed to poorer kids.
Yeah. Yeah, parents are, so a lot of the intensity you see out there and the creation of elite teams is in response to the perception and the reality to a certain degree that there is more scholarship money out there. There's about $1.5 billion a year that's handed out in athletic aid by NCAA schools each year now, which is four times as much as was being handed out in the early 1990s. However, it's a bit of a mirage. These scholarships are they're not full rides. They don't cover the full cost of attendance. In football and basketball, they come close to doing that. But in most other sports, you know, baseball included, track, soccer, a kid might just get $2,500. You know, some small amount that pays for just a little bit of their school. Parents don't really quite realize that. Second of all, that scholarship money can be taken away at any time. It's not a four-year, five-year deal that you get access to. It's a series of one-year deals that the school can has the option to renew, and they can discontinue for any reason if the kid turns out to be not so great, which happens a lot, or if the kid dyed his hair green and the coach doesn't like it. So it's a bit of a mirage, and you've also got to remember that once you have that athletic scholarship, you are now basically an employee of the athletic department. It's not a relationship really with the school. It's a relationship with the athletic department and the coach. And that's tough because in college sports, the surveys show that these kids put in sometimes more than 40 hours a week into their sports, and that's on top of, then you've got your schooling, and there's a real consequence to chasing some of these scholarships, and the scholarships often end up going to kids from families that can afford to stay with the youth sports arms race, as they say, that can afford those $300 bats and the out-of-state tournaments and the $10,000 a year, $5,000 a year it costs to be part of that volleyball club. The demographics of despite what you see on TV, which is usually football and basketball, most college athletes are from homes of means, and so it's actually not a great way for kids from lower income homes to get to college.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Alan and speak with Herrero. Hi, Herrero.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
He reminded me of a book I read by Malcolm Gladwell.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Outliers.
Outliers, exactly. That's where he pointed out, I guess using an example of the Canadian hockey leagues, I believe.
Right.
And that's where he points out that if you look at the teenagers in those leagues, by the time they get to that level, their birthday distribution is within 3 months of a certain date, and I forget what it is, like 80% of them. So it just goes to prove that a body's physical development plays a huge role, and it becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You get all the kids who do well, and more games adds to more experience, and it just, That league proves that if you don't pick them out by physical attribute, then you put a lot of kids at a disadvantage just merely because of their physical development and when their birthday falls with regard to a deadline for a league.
Yeah, and you've also got a lot of parents holding their kids back in school, right, for the same reason?
Yeah, and that's a real phenomenon in Texas, as anybody knows there. I mean, it often happens in middle school. I've seen it happen earlier, where some kid will show some athletic talent, and they'll say, let's pull them back a year and have them repeat sixth grade or eighth grade or whatever else it may be, so therefore they have a better chance of being recruited coming out of college. I mean, it's a constant fight for the slightest of advantages out there. And your caller, what he was talking about was something called the relative age effect, and it shows that, for instance, in hockey, where the age cutoff date is January 1, there's a disproportionate number of athletes who hockey athletes in Canada, and it's true here in the U.S. as well. I talk about it in my book, and Malcolm went into it in more detail in his book that came out 6 months later. But they But a lot, you look at the pro athletes and the Olympians, and they often have birth dates like in the first 3 months of the year. So, and that's a reflection of teams being formed at very young ages, 7, 8, 9 years old, when the coach is trying to figure out who's going to help them win. Well, you know, sometimes having just 6 to 8 to 11 months of physical and cognitive growth is that's what's going to make the difference in a kid making a team. And then he's in that pipeline, and he's the one who gets the development and ultimately, you know, better access to playing college and pro sports.
Well, and it makes sense, too, when so many of us are putting our kids, I'll say it was a mistake now, but both my kids played soccer at 3. And the difference between a kid who was almost 4 and a kid who had just turned 3 was like night and day.
Yeah, it is. It's huge. Think about that. What's that, you know, 10%, 20% of a kid's life? I mean, you know, it's huge. Look, there's nothing even wrong with kids playing at 3 and 4. It's just, what is age appropriate? You know, it's you shouldn't feel bad about that. You want your kids to be active and enjoy it, but boy, when do we start playing games? When do we start holding league standings? When do we start handing out trophies for the winner of a particular league? I mean, that's where things begin to get a bit problematic, because then you end up with a scenario that's not necessarily age appropriate and can push aside a lot of kids.
So what do we do to keep the kids who don't make the elite teams but wouldn't mind still playing involved when they now associate success in a sport with being on the big special team?
Well, I think we need to reinvest in community-based recreational leagues. You know, rec league has become a bit of a ghettoized concept. Like, oh, you play rec. And it's a status kind of thing. And we need to reinvest in that. Instead, you know, have the local soccer league, the local baseball league, really make it a priority of, you know, getting these coaches trained and making it fun and really holding off on creating the elite teams until maybe sixth or seventh grade, and just make rec ball the priority all the way through elementary school.
Tom Ferry is with us. He's a correspondent for ESPN. His book has just been re-released in paperback. It's called Game On: How the Pressure to Win at All Costs Endangers Youth Sports and What Parents Can Do About It. We'll be back in a moment, and if you want to be part of the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. ESPN correspondent Tom Ferry is with us. His book is called Game On: How the Pressure to Win at All Costs Endangers Youth Sports and What Parents Can Do About It. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Maggie in Denton. Hello, Maggie.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment isn't actually about sports, but about other activities that seem to have taken on this level. I have a good friend in the suburban Baltimore area whose daughter expressed an interest in Irish dance, and her mom looked into it, and there wasn't a way to do it casually. And to the mom's credit, you know, she didn't want her daughter to have to basically become a professional Irish dancer, go to competitions, and really make it her whole life just for her daughter to learn how to do this. But I think it's sort of a shame that even at that level, she couldn't do something just casually and learn it without basically becoming professional at it.
Yeah, it is disappointing. What do you think about things like that? And I think a lot of people would argue, Tom, that dance is, in fact, an athletic activity. I guess it's just a matter of encouraging communities to set these opportunities up.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the reason it's gotten to be so, there seems to be no, like, B plan, you know? You want your kid to be involved in something, but like there's the A plan, and it's all ramped up, and then there's no sort of casual option. I mean, there are reasons why the A plan is become such an option out there, and it's in part because of money. A lot of these places, you know, they're just going to make a lot more money if the kid is signed up year round and is really doing the activity in an intensive kind of way. I mean, again, it calls for communities. I mean, literally towns that own some of these public facilities, whether it be soccer fields or gyms or otherwise, to build robust, low-cost programs that are going to serve the needs of a lot of kids. I mean, that used to be the way things were in the, you know, in the 1960s and 1970s, and you know, things have really changed in the past 20 years or so. But when I was coming up, youth sports and a lot of these activities, they were not expensive, and we would do them in low-cost environments. I mean, I think the YMCA still has some of this, some of these type of programs. The Boys and Girls Clubs do, but there's a lot of public infrastructure out there, and you know, I would encourage parents to ask the town that the towns create these environments and prioritize more casual activity rather than just turning over the gyms and the fields to the elite teams and letting them be the priority because they're the ones who have the bucks.
What kind of signs of burnout would you recommend that parents be on the lookout for if they have a child who is a gifted athlete?
When you don't see a passion for the sport, where you're the one who has to, you know, drag them to practice, get them to put their clothes on every time, and you're the one who's trying to get them to improve their game. I mean, the best thing that a coach can do and the best thing that a parent can do is really instill that love of the game in the kid so that it becomes a driver for that kid. The kid wants to go out there in the backyard and kick the soccer ball around, even when he's not practicing, or he wants to play with, you know, create little games with his friends, you know, stick ball type games or whiff ball games in the backyard. That's the kind of behavior you want to look for. And you know, if you're the one doing the pushing, you're the one. If it looks like it's your agenda, and you're the one who's signing your kid up each year, and the kid's not asking to do so, then you might want to check yourself. And you know, I encourage every parent to have a good conversation with the kids. Ask them, okay, you know, what do you want to get out of sports? What do you want to get out of this particular sport? And you know, and then organize the kid's activity around that. If a kid is driven to get a scholarship or become a pro athlete, well, okay, fine. Then put him on a super fast-paced program. But if he just wants to, he or she just wants to have fun, be around their friends, challenge themselves a bit, which is a lot of kids out there, then find programs that fit their needs. Again, they may that's going to make them want to come back, and ultimately they may develop that desire to become something more and really do something with the sport. You know, it may not be at age 8, might be at age 12, but you just want to kind of organize the activity around what their needs are as opposed to what you want them to get out of youth sports.
Let's go next to Ed in Dallas. Hello, Ed.
Hi. I've been listening to Tom's comments, and I have to say he's spot on with his observations, at least from my point of view. One thing that I would add, I came from Southern California, was involved in youth sports there for quite a few years, came out here to Dallas 10 years ago, and I was involved in the youth program here and eventually withdrew from that and got more involved just with the adult side, particularly in the refereeing side, because parents' behavior was just abysmal. Actually, I've seen several women get into fistfights and in teenage girls playing soccer. It was like nuts. And so I, at least with the adults, you can kind of talk to them and reason for the most part. But this is something I'm really concerned about because it puts a very negative light on the game. And I'm not sure what the kids learn from all of that other than their parents have some limitations in judgment.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, and there are a lot of parents like that. There was a survey, it was a study done by the University of Maryland last year that found that 50% of parents on a youth soccer sideline felt the emotion of anger during the course of the game. Now, in many cases, that feeling was gone after 5 seconds or 10 seconds or 30 seconds. But with other people, it lingered, and you end up having, if you got two or three of these parents who feel that way and they're on different teams and they're standing next to each other, you know, at a game, then you're going to have the kind of incidents that you're talking about. I mean, there's a lot of sidelines are exploding out there, and a lot of people really do a good job of tamping down their emotions. But it is a very emotional thing. I feel when I go to my son's games, I'm like, oh, why did the ref call it, or why is my son playing there? Well, how come they can't you know try him out at a different position? I feel all those same things. It's hard to kind of dial this stuff down, and I think it's really because we've created this environment where it's become so elite. We know that if our kid doesn't achieve and doesn't stand out at an early age, that he can get washed aside. And everybody wants their kids to have an opportunity to play and play into the high school level. And it's you know, so there's a lot of pressure on parents to you know, get their kid in a position where they can continue to play. And it's really unfortunate. It really is incumbent upon youth sports organizations to change that environment and not make things so exclusive and stop pushing kids aside at such an early age, so parents can relax a bit and know that, you know, they're still, their kid's going to have a chance to play at, you know, 14 or 15, even if he isn't on an elite team in, you know, third or fourth or fifth grade.
Now, in this country, the U.S. Olympic Committee has actually been charged with sort of ensuring that communities have these baseline level sports for kids. You don't think they've done a particularly good job of making sports available to everybody?
No, they have not. They've basically, people don't know all the history, but essentially the USOC was told by Congress in 1978 that you're in charge of amateur sports in this country, you know, not college football and not the NCAA and so forth, but a lot of the grassroots, the national, you're in charge of the, you know, you certify the national governing bodies of basketball and hockey and, you know, soccer and on and on. And you know, you need to pay attention to the grassroots, you know, fund research that is going to be, you know, can be pushed down the pipeline, encourage coach training, you know, talk to the national governing bodies about how to structure youth programs so that kids are developed with a long-term athletic development model as opposed to just win at an early age. And the USOC has pretty much ignored that mandate. They said, "Look, we don't have enough money or resources or time to focus on that. We're going to put almost all of our resources behind the elite of the elite athletes, those who present themselves usually as adults as among the top, you know, eight or so athletes in the country." And so they have completely abdicated their responsibility. And who knows? You know, President Obama may change that. He created in June, he created something called the White House Office of Olympic, Paralympic, and Youth Sport. And the idea is that you would use this office to coordinate federal resources to get more kids not just involved in a wider array of sports, but keep them involved over a longer period of time, especially kids from the inner cities where sport options are much more limited than they are in the suburbs. So who knows? Maybe he takes a look at the charter of the U.S. Olympic Committee and says, "Look, no, you know, really, you need to pay attention to the grassroots and to youth programs much more than you have in the past." I don't know which direction he's going to go in, but it is interesting that he did create that office a couple months ago. That is a permanent office, and they're going to be dealing with all these issues that we're talking about today.
Let's go next to Arlington, where we'll speak with Margaret. Hi, Margaret.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling. Hi. Give you my two cents about college scholarships.
Great.
I have two daughters that played volleyball, and we didn't get into it to get a college scholarship. We didn't know that was even an option. We just got into it to improve their game in high school, and then you hear all the other parents talking about things that you can and can't do and that you can and can't talk to college coaches and just all of the recruiting rules. And after it's all said and done, had we not played volleyball, we definitely could have just paid for college. So it's a trade-off. And once they are college athletes, you're absolutely right. They have another full-time job plus going to school and getting good grades. It was kind of trying for me as a mother to watch it all, but they both swear they wouldn't ever do it another way, so it was a good experience for them.
Thanks very much for your call. And we shouldn't, you know, neglect to mention the fact that there are people who feel like participation in sports, including high-pressure sports, made them the people they are today.
Yeah. No. Look, sports is good. Sports is good. And if you're going to get good at anything, you're going to have to really focus at some point and turn over a fair chunk of your life to it. I mean, I knew I wanted to be a journalist in high school, and I was working nights and weekends and really focusing at a fairly early age myself. I mean, you know, Roger Federer at some point had to go to a tennis academy and focus. I mean, it does happen. The only question is, what is age appropriate? When is too young to be doing that? What do you want to be teaching six-year-old athletes? And how much competition is appropriate versus 8 or 10 or 12 or 14? So there are these stages that kids need to go through. And, you know, we just haven't really, as a nation, we haven't really thought through what exactly those stages should be. I mean, it's interesting. The former Soviet Union, they had all these sports scientists who put a lot of thought into this type of thing, and they came up with certain models. I mean, you know, a certain percentage of practice versus games at this age, and here's the kind of coaching a kid needs at this given age. And they really kind of thought the whole thing through. And that's not an endorsement of their system versus our system. But boy, we could pay a lot more attention to what the research says out there about what is appropriate in terms of keeping kids involved in sports and ultimately developing better athletes. I mean, this nation has, you know, our national teams have not done so great in the past 20 years for all this focus that we've had on you know, early success in youth sports. Boy, at the end of the line, I mean, look at our national baseball team hasn't done anything in the World Baseball Classic, which is an event we created. Yes, our dream team won at the Olympics last year, but that's, you know, I mean, it was actually the redeem team. Well, it had to be redeemed because they hadn't won anything since 2000. You know, I mean, a nation of 300 million people and the best athletes go into the sport of basketball, and we still couldn't beat the likes of, you know, Puerto Rico and you know, Greece for many years. And it's because, you know, it's because we're not training athletes in the best way. We're not teaching them fundamentals at the right age. We're emphasizing competition too much. We end up creating the star system where kids get really big heads really early on, and ultimately they're training athletes better in some of these other countries than we're training them here.
Do you think parents sort of get this in their heart of hearts and have just needed a push in the right direction?
They need the confidence. I mean, it's scary to think, well, I'm gonna pass on that third grade travel team, or I'm going to pass on that clinic. I mean, nobody wants their kid to be left behind, and I don't want my kid to be left behind. I've done clinics, and we've done the travel thing as well. It's just building in balance. You know, don't be afraid to let kids have free play. Don't be afraid to say no to that out-of-state tournament. Don't be afraid to insist that coaches be trained. That's where parents need to build their confidence.
Tom Ferry is a correspondent for ESPN. His new book is called Game On, How the Pressure to Win at All Costs Endangers Youth Sports and What Parents Can Do About It. Tom, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Chris, thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.